Hello and welcome to a live recording of the Between Dreams podcast. My name is Chris Ruggiero. Thank you guys for joining, especially a big thanks to people who are watching live, and shout out to the people who are watching and listening to the replay in the future. Hello to the future. Today, I had one guest in mind, and it turned into two guests, which feels like it's going to be really awesome. I'm really excited. And one of the things that I wanted to talk about with these two guys is how they are creating something that obviously is attaching to something that people really care about. And as performers, as entertainers, as anything that we do, it's so valuable to think about what will actually resonate with your audience. And sometimes you don't even know what that is until you jump in and do it. These two guys are doing it. It's Simon Carnell and Jordan Gold. And boom, boom, you're here. Welcome, you guys. Thank you so much. Creating something that resonates with 30,000 people is pretty incredible. So first of all, congratulations.
Appreciate it. That's actually a really good insight that you just made, is that has been echoed internally when, obviously, the money is important, but when we've been looking at, e.g., other successful Kickstarters to kind of contact and try and audience share with, the number of backers is much more important than the number of dollars, because that's how many human beings have gone, I'm willing to give this thing money because it's connected with me in some way. And so that number really, don't get me wrong, the money is important, but the actual number of people is actually much more so.
Yeah, and it's like, as entertainers, it's almost, you know, me as a lot, mostly live entertainer, you think about looking out into the audience and seeing 300 people or 1,000 people, and you're like, wow, how incredible is that? And now something that can kind of expand bigger. And I think, Jordan, we were just talking before this, and I think this will dig into it, of like thinking as something that we know as performers, but then expanding beyond that is a really interesting thing. And I feel like you were just on a little jam right before we started recording. So do you want to kind of continue on that, about thinking about that, of expanding and just thinking bigger than we often, because I think it's natural for us to often kind of have a bit of a limited mindset of like, oh, this is what I understand. I don't really understand a 30,000 person audience.
Right.
So how does that resonate with you?
Well, it also didn't start 11 days ago when we launched the Kickstarter. I mean, this project on its own started a year ago, but actually Simon and I have been working on our own separate projects, making bigger magic sort of outside of ourselves as magicians, and outside of ourselves being the performer as magicians. I know Simon worked on an arts festival that he can talk more about. I worked on a convention booth for the game company Exploding Kittens, which was sort of a big non-stop magic show that was happening 8 hours a day on the convention floor. And it was just sort of realizing, as magicians, instead of just thinking of ourselves as performers and going up on stage and doing a show, we can also think of ourselves as designers, because in magic, you're making a lot of decisions about yourself as a performer and the magic that you're doing and the art that you're creating. And all of those instincts that you learn on stage are applicable in other ways. So when we started working on this particular project, which was a jigsaw puzzle, we looked at how jigsaw puzzles are designed, not from a manufacturing standpoint, but from the sort of experience design of what does it feel like to do a jigsaw puzzle. They sort of have this stuffy idea behind them of like, they're kind of boring and like grandma's old jigsaw puzzles. But yet, on the other hand, there's this like really robust fan base of people who love doing them. So clearly there's something there. And we just thought about the whole experience as though we were designing a good performance. And that sort of led us on this year-long journey, which ended up in of course, the Kickstarter campaign. But I think that it's been a really good lesson for both of us that we started off thinking like on this scale of the physical magic trick that I'm designing to do to one person, but the underlying structure of what makes that work, so far we kind of haven't found an upper limit to how big that can go. And I think that it's hard at first, to think about, like, well, how do I take a card trick and show that to millions of people? And it's not about the physical trick. It's sort of, you have to kind of zoom out a little bit and look at what decisions are you making as a performer and why are you doing those things? And how does that help you connect with your audience?
Yeah. And that's one of the biggest things that I've, I think particularly lately been really thinking about is like, and it's a simple, when you say it, it's like so simple of like, oh, why am I doing this bit? Why am I saying this joke? Why am I making this website? Why am I making this product? You know, at any scale of performers or marketing teams or big companies, it's like so relevant. Like, why am I doing this? Because it feel like, because I'm supposed to do card tricks, or because the audience actually wants something fresh and new. And that's a really fascinating point of what you said of testing the limits of like, oh, kind of create something new. And then we don't know how big that can go. Certainly bigger than, you know, thinking in terms of card tricks or even magic tricks.
Well, I think that as performers, we do it a lot intuitively. And like as a juggler, you know that if you drop the ball, it's an inevitable thing and you're going to have some sort of moment for that, right? But as an audience watching, it's like you see a juggler drop a ball and then they have a really funny line. The audiences haven't caught on to the idea that like, yeah, they jugglers know that they're going to drop a ball. Sometimes they do it on purpose. Like, I hope I'm not giving away your secrets, but you can take the underlying idea there is like understanding that there's going to be a moment and it's going to be a real moment. And what is the audience thinking in that moment when you drop a ball? They're thinking, oh, maybe this juggler is not so good. And you can diffuse that by having outthought them and coming up with a response so that the bad thing that happened in your act now has become this nice, wonderful, happy, funny, whatever moment. And the way that you can think about that, the way that you would construct that in your act is applicable in other ways. And it's just a matter of sort of taking those skills and then, as I said, sort of zooming out and saying, okay, well, how can I start to think about other things around me with this lens of what I do know intuitively as a performer about connecting with my audience?
Yeah, perfect.
And there's a very relevant observation that I originally encountered in game design because I only really got into magic when I was 18 at first year university back in Australia, which is very late for most people. It was in no way a childhood passion. The biggest thing I was into as a kid was video games. I wanted to go to university to become like a video game designer, video game programmer. That was like my thing. And one of the lessons from game design, whether video games, board games, is the most important skill for a game designer is listening. Listening to your audience when you're testing. And that, I think, applies to every creative, every design in every field is listening is the most important thing. In a show, what are they saying? How are they reacting after the show? What do they say to you? What do they say to each other? And really being completely focused on your audience and what their experience is and how to really let them tell you that and then to listen and to adapt accordingly.
So how did that kind of relate for you guys as people who understand, because there's some people who, you know, maybe a video game developer has probably never been on stage and had that instant direct access to hearing audience feedback, or a board game designer or a puzzle designer had to make a puzzle first and then get feedback a year later after it goes out there and they realize it doesn't sell and restart it. So like as stage and live entertainment performers, you understand that instant feedback. How did that play into a world that traditionally was never able to have designers who understood instant feedback?
It started on a very small scale. I mean, it started on the magic trick scale. It was, we had access to, like, I have a Cricut Maker, which is a plotter that can cut things out of paper. And we had a friend of ours had a Glowforge, which is a laser cutter. So we had access to these things that could help us make little tiny versions of jigsaw puzzle type things. And really the puzzle itself, the product that's on Kickstarter right now has a lot of different ideas. We sort of reapproached the jigsaw puzzle from the ground up, but we were able to take each one of those ideas and present it to people on a really small scale. So instead of, here's a 1,000-piece puzzle that's going to take you hours to do and give us all your notes. It was, here's this, you know, here's 5 pieces, put them together. And then we would notice, oh, people were having some sort of reaction to it. They were delighted by something about these 5 pieces. And so we were able to sort of distill each element and test it on a lot of people around us, and not just our friends. This was very important. Like, friends of our friends who were total strangers to us and didn't know what we were working on and didn't care anything about who we were, didn't think we were cool, or they didn't even know we were magicians. You would just say, hey, try this thing out and let us know what you think. And so we were able to really test sort of smaller elements before going to the actual prototype of the puzzle itself, which we also learned a lot from. We play tested about 100 people on version 1 of the magic puzzles. And so it, in the last year, it wasn't just a big part of it was designing the final product, but through doing these little tiny sort of mini prototypes, I guess, of experiences that we could tell, oh, there's something here. Maybe it's not exactly what it's going to be. Maybe it will change. Or, yeah, no, this idea doesn't work. Maybe we should shelve it and come back to it later.
Yeah. Yeah, and always being ready to be surprised as well. Like, knowing with certainty that whatever your initial hunches are at least going to be partially wrong, if not entirely wrong. And so you're going out going, right, I know I'm wrong. I just don't know what I'm wrong about. Let's find out. And just leaning straight into that as quickly as possible.
My favorite thing that happens is when Simon has idea number one and he's like, I'm confident that this is the way. And then I have idea number two, which is in direct conflict with Simon's idea number one. And we're like duking it out in theoretical debates of like, no, this is why it's better. And this is why it's better. And we can't come to, we're both like, no, my idea. And we say, okay, let's test it out. Let's get in front of real people. And we find out that we were both super wrong, but that there's this new idea number three that we both agree, oh, idea three is actually really great. And so a lot of time I think a big secret for our work is just Simon and I have each other to argue with and test each other's ideas, which it isn't just somebody telling you your idea is bad and you need to change it. It's more needing to fight for your ideas, because it's really easy to have a thought and then say it out loud and then go, is this a good idea or is it a bad idea? And the truth is it's like no one knows until it's like collapsed into a reality. But if you have somebody that challenges you on these things, it helps you to be able to fight for the ideas that you believe in. And sometimes even if you're just fighting to sell your idea to somebody else, sometimes you'll convince yourself, you know, maybe this isn't really worth fighting. And sometimes you're like, oh yeah, this really is worth fighting for. And those are the ideas that you're like, I think there's something here, because it's, you have to figure out how to know when to believe in your own design concepts, I guess.
Yeah. And that's something that's like, so again, it's, I love when things are relevant out to people who might be listening that aren't entertainers or designing a game or something, of that idea of share, just simply like sharing and maybe fighting for your idea or maybe not, maybe just talking about it. You're like, heck yeah, that's awesome. And you like really sell it to yourself, or you're like, yeah, what was I, that doesn't make any sense.
It's, you know, it's the relationship a performer has with the audience too. Cause you can't sit in your bedroom and come up with an amazing act. Like you can work something out, but you get in front of an audience and you realize, oh, half of these ideas were great and half of them were really bad. And sometimes you get huge reactions for stuff. You're like, that wasn't even supposed to be a big moment, but everyone's like, that was my favorite part of the show. And so that's sort of the thing that we get as performers is we get training in coming up with ideas, putting them in front of people, and then listening to their reactions and then deciding what to keep, what not to keep, how to change it. And that's very similar with the whole design process.
Yeah, as a performer, you learn sort of the value of that, like you said, the rapidity of that instant feedback that's so separate to the design process, where there's usually a much longer gap between testing and feedback. And so as a performer, you know, unless you're sort of just self-indulgently going, I'm great, I don't need feedback, like you get that visceral knowledge of how essential that feedback is. So when you come into a design environment, you're just yearning for that as aggressively as you can find it, as quickly as you can get it.
Yeah. So I was just thinking about piecing this together as a listener of, like, people are probably very intrigued right now of listening through this, and they're like, what could possibly be this intriguing and thoughtful about a puzzle? So for people who haven't seen the video, which even if you have seen the video, we still, as an audience, we still don't really know what this thing exactly is. We see that people are like, whoa, there's this moment. And like a good magic trick and like a good show and like a good movie, like any type of good entertainment, there's going to be a thing that hits you at the end. Can you guys talk a little bit about what it actually is and why people are feeling like this is so special?
How to describe it? It's been a really interesting journey because as we started to think about how to sell and market these things, one of the big selling points is this magical twist ending that we don't want to spoil. And so we've struggled a lot internally with, like, well, do we just spoil it and it's still cool, even if you know? Do we, like, not mention it at all? And I think we clearly seem to have ended up with a pretty good balance. And the cool thing is, I think, because fundamentally the product is a jigsaw puzzle. It's a 1,000-piece jigsaw puzzle. And anyone who's going to buy a 1,000-piece jigsaw puzzle is buying it because they want that experience of that flow state, that calming, soothing progression of what a jigsaw puzzle is. And so anything else just gravy on top, just makes it better. And the biggest thing we found in the testing, we put most of the effort into making this magical ending work using some sort of geometric magic principles that magicians will be very familiar with, but most people in the general public won't. But one of the other core ideas was doing art, commissioning art for the puzzles that was enjoyable at the piece-by-piece level, as opposed to just when you get to the end, like most conventional puzzles. And in the testing, we put all the work into, like, the ending, and we commissioned an artist to do some great little art. Yep, cool, that's whatever. And then in the feedback we got from the 100 or so people who tested it was maybe about 30% commented on how cool the ending was, and 70% were going, oh, and I love the little details and the art. The art was so adorable. And we realized actually that was a much bigger enjoyment point than the actual magical ending. And so both are good deal sweeteners, but the art alone was more than enough to sell the idea.
We looked at how jigsaw puzzles were made in the past, and they take a piece of art that's safe and nice, and then they chop it up into a bunch of pieces and they put it in a box and they sell it. And occasionally they'll, you know, license some IP and you have like a Disney version of it or something like that. But there wasn't a lot of thought other than just chopping up a piece of art. And so you look at a puzzle that you find in a store, and as soon as you look at the box, you know what the art is. And then you put the pieces together, and at the end you go, yep, this is the piece of art that I chose to chop up. Okay, I guess I did it, and now we're done.
Put the rope back in the box.
And so we really, when we started working with these illustrators and started working on this tiny scale, it's not just that our pieces are more interesting because they have a little character as opposed to a smudge of red sky or, you know, grass or something like that. It's that we have a, if you think about like a Where's Waldo book, there's so much detail packed in there and you can stare at it for hours, but you can't actually stare at a page out of the book for 10 hours. You couldn't, like, you would go crazy. Like, you just can't notice all the things the artist put in there. But in a jigsaw puzzle, it's actually designed for you to sit there for lots of hours putting the pieces together, noticing every single detail, because you're looking at a piece and going, what's on this piece? Where does this piece go? And if when we noticed that when we worked with these illustrators, all of a sudden, instead of going, this is a red piece, it must go with the other red pieces, you go, oh, there's a cat on this piece. Oh, and it belongs on this island full of cats. And this cat is doing something, and it's interacting with other cats on the cat island. And now you're looking at a piece that you're telling yourself a story about what it is. And it has a relation to the other pieces and the bigger puzzle. And now all of a sudden you're diving into this whole imaginative world designed by the artist. And you're just in a completely different space than I'm doing 400 pieces of, you know, sky on this hillside puzzle that are all the same texture all the way through. So we started with that as you're putting it together. You get this fun experience of actually getting to interact with the art. And then we have this ending where instead of putting the last piece in and then the puzzle's over, you put the last piece in and then something happens. And it's something that works dynamically with the art and with the story that the art's telling. So we found that, you know, the problem with jigsaw puzzles, as far as most people were concerned, and this sort of idea that they're boring, wasn't the jigsaw puzzles. It just was the lack of sort of imagination in all of the things you can do with a jigsaw puzzle. And it isn't until all of a sudden somebody does something different that everyone else goes, oh, now this is possible. This is a new thing that we can do. We didn't know we could do.
Yeah. And it's such an interesting thing of, you think about it, even so, to go back to magic or juggling or variety shows, what was always fascinating to me was to create something that, you know, as a juggler, I would always try to think of a way to make it where, like, somebody that from when they were a little kid, they were like, no, I don't like jugglers, because everyone has seen a bad juggler and a bad magician when they were a kid, or every juggler or every magician that they had seen, because it was three of them and they were terrible. They were like, no, I don't like that. And there's a lot of people who are like, no, puzzles are boring. I don't like that. So what's so cool is creating something that people are now going to be interested in the puzzles because it's something big. So this is building upon Jordan, what you were just saying is, like, people are buying this not because they love puzzles, but because they love an awesome experience that at the end of the day is like, I never wanted to be a good juggler. I never wanted to be a good anything. I wanted to be someone who created an experience for the audience. And that's so awesome that you, like, brought that all together into this.
Yeah. I think that people that love doing puzzles are going to really love doing ours, because it's the experience of a jigsaw puzzle, but we've added so much more to it. And the really rewarding part is people who say, I hate jigsaw puzzles, or I didn't care about jigsaw puzzles, but this one made me care about jigsaw puzzles. And that is, like you were saying, we have the same problem as magicians, where somebody sees one magician and then they make their entire opinion about magic and magicians based on that one performance. And hopefully it's not terrible, but if it is, it's like, now I have to live up to that. But once somebody sees a juggler or a magician or something that breaks somebody doing something really good that breaks their idea of it being a bad thing, then they sort of realize, oh, the art isn't bad. I just saw somebody who did a bad job, but I also saw somebody who did an amazing job. And now I'm interested in what other amazing versions of this art form are there out there.
Yeah. The thing about just externalizing the concept back out to other fields is that every field in the world intrinsically has its status quo. What's the normal, what's the standard juggling, magic, puzzle design, accounting, like whatever you pick. And it is, I don't know of any field where that status quo is as good as it can be. There is always room for something to be better, even if most people don't know where it is. And so I think whatever you're doing, trying, it's hard, step back and look at it from a fresh, naive eye. If I had no preconceptions or intuitive judgments about this, what could be better? Where could it be more interesting, more surprising, more subversive, more whatever? And I think it was actually lucky for us to be basically outsiders of the jigsaw puzzle world. And we ended up, because someone else had the idea, I reckon jigsaw puzzles could be cooler if you innovated. And we went, maybe they could, and started applying magician brains to that. And the other concept that's very innate to magic is variants on the saying of, most people stop thinking at the point where they should be starting thinking. Most people just learn the trick and go, yep, I've learned the trick, good, done. Whereas no, like in the better ways, you learn the trick, right, that brings you to zero. Good, you're up to zero. Now you use that as your baseline and do something interesting or different with the trick. And that's sort of galaxy brain evolved magic. And I think in every field that applies as well.
It's what I always loved about juggling as a metaphor is you either can juggle or you can't juggle. Like there's no, oh, I'm a good juggler. It's like, okay, juggle these balls for me. It's like, can't do it. It's like, there's, of course there's like levels of that. Right. But there's a much clearer, like, I can juggle three or I can't. And then there's everything you can do on top of that. And you don't just stop when you finally get three going. When you get a three ball cascade and it's like, oh, I'm a juggler now. I never have to do anything ever again. I just, where's my money? Where's the money coming from? Where are my gigs, right? It's like, that's the point that you have to start going, okay, now that I've acquired the ability to do the baseline of what I need to do, now what? Like, now I can start doing variations or figuring out like what other people are doing, building on that. Maybe I'm going to say something. And there are people who are technically incredible that can, you know, juggle eight or nine, whatever. But then there's also people that can juggle three or four and do beautiful stuff with it. So it's not just about the level of proficiency. It really is like, what do you want to say with it? And that's the fun part of being a performer is that space that you get to play in.
I still remember back from, this goes back decades, long before I was into Magic, but that whole like Chris Bliss, Jason Garfield thing, right? He was just juggling three and everyone just loved it and cared. And then Jason was a way better technical juggler, but no one gave a crap. And in that dichotomy, because Chris was doing something that the general audience was responding to, that Jason just couldn't see and didn't understand because he was only thinking about this element of what he was doing.
Yeah, and I'm so glad that you guys tied that all back together. Because initially, Jordan, you were saying, yeah, you can start with three balls, but then you're going to progress into more, in five, seven, nine, whatever, more objects, weirder objects. And I was like interested to see how that kind of circled back, because what I was always interested in was kind of the opposite of that. Like, what I never did super technical things, but I was always trying to figure out, how do I make people care about three balls? How do I make people care about three clubs? And how do I, you know, it was never do seven, because where's that really going to get us?
Well, you know what? Shit, actually, there's another parallel with what we've discovered about jigsaw puzzles in the last year of kind of starting to really think about and research and study jigsaw puzzles. Is most people, when you say we're doing an innovative jigsaw puzzle with something different, almost everyone assumes that means harder, more pieces, or like, you know, that Ravensburger blank puzzle. That's when, similar to juggling. I think, yeah, harder, just go on that one dimension. And it's like, what about more delightful, more surprising, more enjoyable, more flow state inducing? There's so many other directions you can progress in. It's not just one linear sense of progression. You can take any field in all kinds of different ways that are often worthwhile.
Yeah, I love that. I love that how that tied also into the thing, that into that puzzle. Yeah, because you're like, oh, it's going to be crazy. Like, oh, is it 10,000 pieces and it's going to take me four months to do? That's how a puzzle person would think about how, you know, in that one track. Oh, bigger, more.
Like a technical juggler, like a hardcore. And that's actually something as well in the design. We very explicitly, one concept that came up very early on in this of thinking it as a business fundamentally, that we want it to be delightful but profitable, is going for the broadest possible potential appeal. You never know if people are going to like your thing, but at least have the opportunity for as many people as possible to discover they like it. And so rather than just going, okay, this is like the circle of all humans, and then anything you do will then shrink it. And e.g. in like, say, technical juggling, it's going to be like people who are into juggling and then people who are into technical juggling, and it gets very niche. And to be fair, these are mostly based on people who are into jigsaw puzzles, but we want them to be easy and accessible. Because if you make a puzzle really hard, there's people who are going to love that. But our hunch was that's far fewer people than would like an easy, enjoyable, calming, flow-inducing puzzle. That's a probably much bigger section of the human population. But most people assume that you try and make it hard, that you can make this harder to appeal to hardcore puzzle people, because surely that's who you want, right? You want the respect of the hardcore people. Like, no, you might. There's nothing wrong with that, but that's not what we're seeking. We're trying to find something that's for as many people as possible.
I also think that one of the most important things that Simon and I have been able to do in our Magic careers is really look outside of the niche world of Magic and draw inspiration from literally anywhere else that's not within Magic. Like, it's good to know what's going on in your lane, but it's also good to just take in as much content from everywhere else as you can. And, you know, before we launched the Kickstarter, which was 11, 12 days ago, We were working with our friend Eat It Katie, who is a food blogger, and she wrote some advertisements for the Chicago Board Game Cafe in Chicago. And she said, hey, I pitched these ads and they got approved. And do you want to make these videos? And it was, I did one where I was producing cards at my fingertips, but the cards were blank cards that we'd written her copy on. So the cards are like talking to the audience. And Simon did a similar one with cards with messages, but they sort of changed, the cards changed around and did like a little magic trick, but it wasn't, you know, we're trapped in our houses. We don't have an audience. Our shows are all canceled. And we weren't thinking, how do I do my ambitious card routine to my computer and make money? We're looking outside of what we were used to doing. And we found other people to collaborate with. And actually, like, I think the magic that Simon and I did was fine, but it was really Katie's writing that made it like a fun, snappy ad and really tied the whole thing together. And without her writing the copy for us, it would just kind of be lame, you know, like, oh, look at this. I'm producing cards. I don't know. What am I doing here? And I think that the same way that we were able to sort of take a step back from what we thought we should be doing, our own material that we're so comfortable in, and saying, what do I have to work with and who do I have to work with, really opened up our availability for creating something. And sure, that wasn't on the scale of the puzzles, but it also was on a scale of, you know, hey, we're filling a need right now. We're making ads for restaurants and they're fun and creative. And also, they're not local. Like, we're making ads in LA in our houses for a restaurant in Chicago. And we did that with a couple emails and our iPhones. So there's the world is like way open, especially for us as performers, because our superpower is understanding how to design something for an audience. It's all we do. And whether that's juggling or magic or whatever your art is, you're designing it for an audience. And that's the same thing that the restaurant is doing, and they're trying to reach their audience. The same thing that all these businesses are doing. So there's, for us, we worked on a product that we could put in, hopefully, ideally, eventually, stores that we could sell that wasn't us standing on a stage. And we were working on that a year ago because we still wanted to build something that was out, the sort of bigger than just us performing on stage. It had nothing to do with the current reality that we're living in. It just was sort of we got lucky that the thing we were working on wasn't canceled by the situation. I think that the reason I brought up the example of the ads was just because we were thinking about this long before, you know, we had this quote, big successful project. Like, this is a sort of a way of taking our skills and trying to look at them in a different way and apply them in more creative ways to the world around us.
Yeah.
I left you that spot there, Simon. I felt like something was going to pop in there. Here, Ryan asked, what's the project called? Is there a link? And we just dropped a link into the comments here, if on the looks like most people are probably here on Facebook, so that's there. And for people who are listening later, what's the best way that people could find it while we're thinking about that?
Easiest way, there's actually an even simpler link, which is pzl.biz/Kickstarter, or actually just pzl.biz takes you to our webpage, which points straight to the Kickstarter. We made our own URL shortener for our puzzle projects.
Nice. Cool. Well, so it looks like there's a handful of people watching and listening here on this live. So I like to give them an opportunity. So if anyone that's actually watching live right now during the actual recording, if you want to drop a question or a comment or anything for these guys to address, you can feel free to drop a comment and we'll pop it up onto the screen and we'll chat about it. And otherwise, we wanted to kind of tie this up here. Is there anything that I know you guys have been doing, like, you know, in a million directions, I can only imagine. And you've been chatting with tons of people. Is there anything specifically about the project or about the process or anything that you are like super intrigued and fascinated by that other podcasts and other people that you've been talking to haven't specifically asked, but you wish that they would, so you could share something that you're really proud of about it?
I think one of my favorite stories about it was told on a recent podcast we were on. What's it called? Two Onions? Is that the name of it?
Yeah.
If you're comfortable with sort of not PG material, there'll be some swearing and some adult themes on that podcast, fully aware, given who runs it, that you can discover for yourself if you're into that. But one of the most weird, the story behind how this all came to be is a really complex one full of twists and turns in multi-layered craziness. And there was a good part of that story was on that. Just about so much of this was planned and so much of it was just total coincidence. And it's like that thing, you know, that thing of like life is what happens when you're making other plans. And a lot of this was us kind of seeing an opportunity that came up out of nowhere, but then having the training and the foresight to go, this is a great opportunity and it's worth jumping on and going in hard on.
Yeah, I can build on that as well. I think that the most interesting thing for me when we hit the launch button and then watched the project unfold, and we're still watching it unfold, was that it wasn't just the culmination of the previous year of working on this thing and being able to release this project. It was actually the culmination of the previous 10 years. And I hadn't really thought about that until we were into the project launch, of really realizing that all of these sort of separate trips and relationships and shows and gigs and experiences and all these things that I was doing while trying to figure out where I was going to be as a magician in the world, they all kind of culminated together into this one project in some way or another. And we have a lot of friends that we've made along the way that contributed in some part, either directly being our business partners or indirectly in some sort of either in helping with the project by giving us feedback or in helping by being somebody who hired us for a gig 5 years ago that ended up being some creative project that gave us new insight that helped us in creating the puzzles. And I think that as somebody who was a performer and a magician who was doing gigs and trying to make it work, it was pretty exciting to realize that like all of these things that really felt like they weren't leading to anything were leading somewhere. And really I was growing as a person and I was learning stuff and I was taking lessons away from mostly my failures, I guess, you know, cause you learn a lot more from failures. But like, it's hard to say successes and failures because, you know, I would do a gig and learn a lot from it and it would, you know, pay a bill, but it's hard to look at that and be like, oh, I'm successful now. I did a gig, you know? But all of those things really became part of who I am as a magician, as a designer, as a puzzle designer, whatever you want to call me. They all added up. And it wasn't until I finally had this, you know, validating project that you can look at and go, ah, I've made a thing that matters now to somebody. But it all of this stuff I was making before mattered just as much. In fact, a lot of it mattered more to me than this does. Like, this is great and super cool, but like it's that struggle of making art and caring about it and then wondering, does this art matter? And if it matters to you, then yeah, it does matter and keep doing it, you know?
Yeah. That's so, 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 so key. As you were saying that, I was thinking about how good of just that moment will be to clip out and utilize as relevant to so many things. Of I've seen so many things that I've done of a YouTube video that has 27 views on it. And, you know, a 100% YouTube failure, you know, or a YouTube video that has 2,000 views, total YouTube failure. And, but I have, you know, 400 videos on my YouTube channel And now I have opportunities of making videos and people calling me, asking me about video production and other entertainers hiring me to produce their live streams. And it's like, that's because of all of those videos that were failures, quote failures for the people listening. Those were air quotes. So yeah, I love that of like, and it's like, as performers, as live entertainers, people, I think you almost have an advantage of understanding that by getting on stage every night and doing a bar show somewhere in LA or somewhere in the world, and people are more interested in happy hour, and you're like, okay, that sucked, and I'm really going to be pissed off tonight when I'm laying in bed after this. But then the next day you're like, well, I could have done that. And you think back and then you develop something that's awesome. And I love that it's like something like this that culminates all of it together. And it's like such a cool thing.
I remember a show I did early on. It was like, oh man, it must've been like almost 20 years ago, but it was this local bar and poker room up in Northern California. And the owner of the establishment hired me to come do magic for the patrons for like an hour. And these were like crusty, old, like weathered people. And they didn't give a crap about my card tricks. There was some young kid coming in and I was like, I'm pretty sure I was wearing like a suit and a tie. These are people who are like smoking at, you know, 3 o'clock in the afternoon. And oh man, it was like a very rough gig, you know, to try and get people to care. Cause I thought, oh, I'm a magician, people are going to care. And they were like, no. And I ended up like sitting at the bar after 20 minutes because I tried to approach everyone and no one wanted to talk to me. I'm like, I guess I'll just sit at the bar and drink with these people. And then they started opening up to me and then they were talking to me and you know, and I've, at the end of the day, I might have done one trick or something, but looking back on it, it wasn't like a total failure. Like it was, first of all, it was a great learning experience, but I'm much more appreciative that the dude who owned the place said, yeah, here, kid, I'll give you $50 or whatever it was to come do magic. Like that, at the end of the day, that guy believed in whatever I was doing. Didn't matter what the other people thought. And I appreciated that he at least gave me the chance to fail rather than just saying, nah, you know, like we don't want you around here. So, just get out there and do stuff. Cause yeah, there's no YouTuber who uploaded a video and it was on the front page the next day, their first video ever. Every single one that you look at started by making crappy videos that had 5 views each and building up from there. And because you learn stuff from that, you learn how to make better videos. And then eventually that's how you teach yourself how to make good videos.
I that sparked an idea that I forget which you guys were both talking on another podcast, and I wanted to kind of spark that one thing of, I think a lot of people are, they have ideas, but they kind of hold on to them of like, well, I don't want to post this. I don't want to share this because somebody else is going to grab it. That's obviously huge in juggling magic variety show world. Certainly true in every other business of people like being protective of their idea. And one of the fascinating things in another interview with you guys that I heard you guys talk about is how just like you could kind of give away the idea. And it would be so complex and not that it's more complex, but the idea is so much you that it would be just like so difficult for anyone to duplicate it. And I love that idea of, I just saw somebody else post something about like, somebody's like ripping off this bit that I do. And it's like, cool. That means it wasn't that special. If somebody else can do it and it works, like figure out a bit that you can do, figure out a business, figure out an act, figure out a YouTube channel that like when other people try to rip it off, it just doesn't work because it's so you. And I love that about what you guys are doing. Do you have any kind of, and we'll kind of tie it up here maybe with that concept of like trying stuff, you'll find your thing, but you're never going to think of your thing. You're going to find your thing by digging through a bunch of stuff that doesn't work, which I think relates to how we started and it'll be a nice package.
I think there's a couple of two things that have been really on my mind that have guided a lot of this that holy crap, it's nice, it's worked out. I mean, I've spent most of the last 15 years of my life spending a year on a project, like a show I've been writing or something, and then I finally, it's ready and I launch it, and it's not a failure, but not a success either. It's okay, and then didn't go anywhere, and I just had to kind of swallow the disappointment and get to work on the next thing. And dozens of times I've done that, and this is the first time I've worked for a year on something and it's actually taking off in some way, and it's so deeply gratifying. Like the morning after we hit a million, I woke up, I sat down at my desk, and I just broke down sobbing. Like it was that intense a release that like finally a thing actually worked in some real meaningful way. But one concept is this Derek Sivers idea that I know I've talked about before, because it was Max, one of our founders, talked about it, that ideas are much less valuable than execution. If you're a good executor, that's so much more valuable than a good idea person. Ideas are good, but only as a multiplier of execution. If you take great execution first, then add a great idea, and that amplifies to something extraordinary. But even without a good idea, good execution is still incredibly valuable. You can take an unoriginal, basic, dumb idea, like open a coffee stand. That's barely an idea. That's such an odd. But if you execute the crap out of it and do that so well, that'll make money and that'll be successful and it'll be good. And that's valuable. And then the second thing is the more you do something, the better you get at it. And having a good idea is not nearly as valuable as being a person who comes up with good ideas over time. Because one good idea might be great. Like let's say this Kickstarter, this is amazing, but this isn't career making. This isn't enough to live on for the rest of our careers. If this is our one good idea, we're screwed. Our lives will trail off and then go back into obscurity.
Well, we're fine for like a year and then we're...
Oh, yeah. Oh, that's great. We've got the next year or two sorted, but that's not nearly enough. Instead, what we've been doing for decades now is cultivating the ability to generate good ideas and then execute them really well. And that's a career and a life path to become better. So rather than coveting the one idea, work on the ability to keep generating new ones and then keep going and then execute them brilliantly, work with other people who can. And that's what I've been focusing on for years now, is trying to steer myself in that direction.
There's also, if it's really hard to actually steal somebody's act or idea. Like you can take it. You can take every single part of it, but you can't really steal that person's the special thing that's going on there. And as magicians, we've had a really interesting relationship with this thing you're talking about, working with the guys at Cards Against Humanity, because on the one hand, we are very secretive about our special ideas that we hold near and dear, that we go, it's hard to come up with something new in the world of magic. And if you can, and if you do, if you're lucky enough, you're like, this is the most precious thing to me. I can't let this get taken. And inevitably, that's just, if something's in the world, it's going to be in the world. And if it's not, somebody else is probably going to come up with it eventually. But with the Cards Against Humanity partners that we have, their whole thing was like, we don't care. That game started as a free giveaway. They not like free and also for sale. Only free. They came up with an idea and they said, here you go, world. You can print it out at home. Do the work yourself. And then people said, we don't want to do that. We'd rather just buy the game. And they said, oh, okay, I guess we'll print it. And now 10 years later, it's like the number one game ever in the history of the world. But it's their relationship with all this stuff is, yeah, who cares? Like, it's probably going to get stolen anyway, but it doesn't matter. And when you create something that is at that caliber, you can't actually steal it. And there's a ton of knockoffs around the world. There's like Crabs Adjust Humidity, which is the weirdest way to steal something. It's like an expansion, but it's like non-licensed expansion that kind of sounds similar, I guess. And then you have other ones that are like the Cards Against Humanity times Star Wars, which is actually stealing multiple people's property. And it's on Facebook, and there's lots of people who are like, oh my God, so-and-so, we should get this. Oh, this is going to be so fun. The customers don't realize that this is a fake product. And those people are making money by ripping off something that's popular, and that sucks. But at the end of the day, like nobody can actually create anything that's the same level as Cards Against Humanity. And I, part of what I learned by working with them was how much design goes into that game. And you look at the cards, you go, this is a most, like 90%, it's a blank card with one word on it. But you look at that word and you start cracking up hysterically. You haven't even played it with the other cards yet. Just the way that it's executed, the way that it's laid out, the fonts that they use, the decisions that they make, it seems like there is no design, but there's so much that went into those that most people don't realize, especially the people that are ripping it off. They're thinking that the success lies in the layout of the words, the crabs adjust humidity. If we get close to what their name is, all of a sudden we're going to hit their success. And the truth is, it's their decisions as designers, and it's thousands of decisions that go into every single part of their product. And you can steal an idea or a couple ideas, but all of the really big successful things in the world aren't one idea. There are thousands of ideas. And that's true of this puzzle too. Like, yeah, it has a magical ending and has tiny art, but there's a thousand other decisions that are, we're not selling to you because we can't list them all and they're not exciting. But if you were to take our puzzle and hold it side by side with another one, you would see immediately all the decisions that we made that aren't even being considered in other products. And you can do that comparison side by side with lots of different things in board games, in video games, with performers, even just like the way that performers decide to dress and talk and carry themselves. Like, these are all little tiny decisions that aren't the joke, the thing that we're all arguing about, hey, you stole my bit. But all of the things around it, usually it's very rare that sometimes you see somebody steals like the list of 1,000 decisions that a performer makes. It's happened. There was that guy that stole Lance Burton's whole act and did the choreography, had the music, every single bit. But that guy is only ever going to be able to steal something else that's been created. He can't make anything. So, and Lance, like, yeah, that was his amazing act, but he had a whole show full of amazing stuff. And at the end of the day, even if somebody stole his entire Dove act, they can't steal his show. They can't steal his career. They can't be him.
And they can't steal his ability to keep creating and innovating and discovering and doing new stuff. Because again, no one rides out a whole career on one idea. It'll get you a long way, but you've got to keep kicking goals over time and having those misses in between. That's fine. You know, the 123 new YouTubes for videos for everyone that really kicks ass.
It's like a cover band, you know, it's like a cover band has a place. Like, they could be the incredible musicians, play other people's songs, and that's a cool thing. But like, there's a reason why they're kind of playing other people's songs instead of deciding to make their own. And again, it's like, that's a little bit different because there's a little bit more integrity to being a cover band than being a magic ripoff person. But
it reminds me of that saying that don't seek to follow in the footsteps of those before you, seek what they sought. Mm. And that stuck with me from a long time ago.
Yeah, that's great. Say that again.
Don't seek to follow in the footsteps of those before you, seek what they sought.
Right.
Don't just imitate. Go for that same, again, and what they sought is always an amazing experience for an audience, one way or another, through whatever their medium is. You want people to go, that thing I experienced, that board game, that video game, that movie, that juggling act, that whatever, that was great. I loved that. I would tell my friends to go see that. I want to see that again. Like, that's always the goal.
Yeah, and to double down on that, I forget what band it was. It was years ago. I remember seeing an interview with a band, and they were talking about how the person asked them like what music they were listening to while they were recording their album, and they said they disconnected completely from any modern music, and they listened to and they were like a pop band. Yeah. They just listened to classical music, like for like the months of while they were recording, so that they weren't influenced by any pop or modern music. They were actually going to the core of things. And I think that's a cool thing that's like relevant to, you know, and music is a one that like, yeah, we can listen to the type of music that people were creating 1,000 years ago.
I love them. Ryan Kane in the comments just pointed out that, yeah, all of these stories also have exceptions. None of these are universal. none of this is always true. That's another important note. Like, all advice is wrong for some situations. That's been one of my pet peeves. I've had a lot of advice in my life that's great advice, but didn't work for my particular situation. I'm like, that's not useful advice to me and what I'm trying to do. Everything has exceptions. There's no universal principles, even that one.
Love it.
It's definitely, as magicians, especially for me, like the getting comfortable and used to letting go of ideas and not being overprotective has been really, really, really hard for me to like fall into and trust. But the only thing that allowed me to do that was working with somebody who was so avant-garde-ly, just like, who cares? Give it away. We're going to get ripped off. It doesn't matter. It won't matter to us in the end. And it was everything in my core was like, I don't believe that. I don't want to believe it. And I don't want to trust it. And I finally was like, okay, it'll be okay. And like the thing's going well. And so I don't know. It's helped me to sort of release that as a notion a little bit.
I remember it's a thing that we've talked about a lot is whenever we'd be getting pissed off about some jerk off magician ripping off something on Instagram or whatever, and we're like, this shitty person. I always would observe, hold on a minute. If our lives were great and we were happy with what was going on and achieving stuff, this wouldn't be bothering us. It's bothering us because that person is, through being a douchebag, absolutely, it is a wrong thing, getting success that we don't have. If we were all right, and so it's better to focus our attention on trying to improve our own situation. Let's focus on trying to succeed at what we're doing, because then that stuff wouldn't be bothering us. And yeah. If what do you want out of life? What do you want? Financial stability, meaningful relationships, to be doing good in the world, all those things. If you can achieve those things, and if, that's a big fucking if, like that's hard, that's a rare thing to achieve. But at that point, you don't care if someone's ripping you off. You still don't want them to, but it won't bother you unless you're missing something in your own life that you're really feeling the lack of.
Yeah, at least we have Rob's blessing here. He said, he just got here. He said, hey guys, hope you guys make your fundraising goal.
One of the many things about this journey I've enjoyed the most is Rob's various posts and updates. Rob is one of the funniest people I know.
His profile photo right now, as always during my shows, says, I'm commenting on Between Dreams.
It's funny. That's one of just the best things is that, I mean, I moved here from across the world to that LA community of just variety artists and entertainers. And I mean, Booby Trap brought a lot of us together. It's such a great environment of where I've met and got to know so many cool people. I hope it all comes back. Really do in this weird time.
Yeah, it's awesome. Well, and it's awesome that we could probably chat for forever on the stuff, but we'll tie it up there. And thank you guys so much for sharing. If we think about more, maybe we'll do another, we'll bring together another recap here in a few months to see where this all evolves to. Cause I think it'll be awesome to see. Cause it's like so fascinating to me of like, this is crazy, you know, and it's like rocking. And then it's like, as this whole conversation has led to is like, in 2 months, you guys are going to be in a different world. And like, you're like, oh, I could have never imagined like thinking about this idea of like, what's next. And it's going to be because you executed and did the things. And here, before we bounce out, we'll kick back over to when we started this podcast almost exactly an hour ago. So we hit just about an hour ago. I was like, oh, we're at, and earlier today it was like 1.5 million or something. I believe you guys probably have it just like a ticker going that you're like watching. But we started this, it was like 1.6 something. Now we're almost at 1.7 million. So it's just like every moment there's more people getting excited about this, which is overall just a really exciting thing. So, and I know you guys are having like an insane next 15 days.
Yeah.
So appreciate the time and all the thoughts. As we were talking through this, I know there was like every 5 minute clip of this is going to be so awesome and valuable to cut out and share. So appreciate all the time and all the thoughts and all the hustle of, you know, people see that number and they see 30,000 people that care about what you're doing, but they don't see the year that led up to this and the lifetime that led up to that year. So appreciate what you guys are doing and executing instead of thinking about the ideas. And Rob agrees. So thank you guys so much again. And it's like, if anyone is looking at you, I tried it earlier. If you type Magic Puzzles Kickstarter, it finds you guys. And remind me again, what's the actual the shortened URL?
PZL.biz, puzzle.biz.
All right, you got it. All right, thanks again, guys. And thanks to everyone watching live, watching and listening live, and also to everyone watching or listening on the replays, Spotify, YouTube, wherever you listen to podcasts, Between Dreams Podcast. And we'll see you on the next one. That's it for now. Thank you. Goodbye.